there is a small chance that it might collapse the circulation, because also their models have problems in reproducing the processes that we think are really important, which also means that you look at maps of global warming. The global warming is often weakest in the North Atlantic because you reduce the inflow of warm water from further south with the slowdown of this ocean circulation. So we still have warming everywhere. It's just somewhat weaker potentially in the North Atlantic and then maybe in Ireland and Iceland.
Do we really know all the ramifications of early sea ice loss in the Arctic? Could this trigger a system elsewhere on the planet? Are there teleconnections with things like rainfall in the Amazon or wildfires in North America?
I would be surprised if we would find anything like that, because for the climate system, there isn't anything particularly special about even losing the last ice floe in the Arctic, because for the climate system, we have already lost half of the sea ice cover in the Arctic. And one could imagine that the impact of this first half is roughly equally large as losing the second half as well. There could, of course, be surprises, but because of the jet stream and other phenomena, the Arctic is a bit isolated from the rest of our planet, both in terms of its connection to the world's ocean, but also in the atmosphere, where we certainly do have connections, but I personally do not expect any major impact from this loss of summer sea ice on sort of the major weather patterns that we have further south. There is, of course, this possibility, but we have relatively weak evidence in that direction.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Arctic sea ice may disappear in summer in the next 10 years. Alex talks with ice expert Dirk Knotts from the University of Hamburg.
Your team doesn't suggest we try to save the sea ice with geoengineering, like blasting sulfur into the stratosphere over the far north. Why not?
We haven't really looked into sort of ways of potentially saving the ice, and I'm certainly not an expert on geoengineering. And my take on geoengineering is that much of that, whether we do it or whether we don't do it, at the end of the day, will be a societal decision. But the problem that I know with many of the geoengineering methods suggested is that they usually have adverse side effects, negative side effects, and at least some other parts maybe of the planet. And so at the end, deciding as to how we potentially might change the climate or how we want to affect the climate will be politically extremely difficult to sort out. And so even if we were to stabilize the global mean temperature by putting solar mirrors into the space, it would be a different climate in many regions of the world, even though the average it would be the same. So in that sense, I think we are currently doing geoengineering in the sense of putting a lot of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere and by that way changing the climate through technical methods. And I think the only technique that we can agree on that would make sense would be to reverse this geoengineering that we're currently carrying out by putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere by trying to remove them again and store them at somewhere underground, for example.
And the new study says the early arrival of a seasonally open Arctic sea means humanity needs to plan and to adapt to a new reality. What plans could we make? How could we adapt?
Well, I guess the primary impacts of an ice-free Arctic Ocean will be for the people who live in the Arctic, but many of them are already adjusting to the new reality of having much longer ice-free periods in summer, having winters where ice might not form where it used to form. For example, in Greenland, I've talked to some of the hunters there who told me that they are not using their dog sledges anymore because there's no safe sea ice to travel on anymore. So they just go fishing all winter round. And so in that sense, they are already adapting. But of course, given the current tensions that we have, the fact that suddenly in the Arctic, the states that border the Arctic, including Russia, including the US with Alaska, including Canada, including the European countries, if there suddenly is completely open water in summer, it of course means that there is much easier connection also between these countries. And I guess also in that direction, there already is a lot of planning happening that we probably don't know about.
You know, it seems to me this paper in Nature is part of a newer process I'm seeing in science. In the 1990s, we did not have enough data, so scientists depended heavily on climate models alone. With three decades under our belts and more sophisticated sensors, there is a better chance to compare model results with the observed record. And that's really what you've done in this paper, isn't it? Do you see it as a change in climate science?
Yes, absolutely. Also, with some of the earlier studies that I've been involved in, where we found a very, very clear linear relationship between the Arctic sea ice cover and the CO2 emissions, which allowed us to calculate that for each ton of CO2, metric ton of CO2 that a person emits, about 3 square meters of Arctic sea ice disappear. That number and that finding was primarily based on the observational record. And so the only information we took from the climate models for this study was the fact that this linearity also exists in every climate model and basically will be kept up until all the ice is gone. So we basically can extrapolate the observed record into the future to get some estimate of when the Arctic will be ice-free. And the fact that we now have a much longer record also means that we can much clearer identify those models that really have problems when simulating Arctic sea ice and those that seem to do an okay job. Because, of course, always when it comes to analyzing model simulations, we do have the large problem of internal variability, chaotic changes in the climate system that happen on top of the very clear signal of anthropogenic warming that we, of course, identify in every model simulation.
You have been researching sea ice for more than a decade, publishing many papers. What do you think is left to be done?
Well, I think from my perspective, the real big questions when it comes to sea ice research currently are emerging in the Southern Ocean. Because in the Southern Ocean, we have a situation that we there have a lot of sea ice in winter and very little in summer. And so in some sense, the Arctic is getting more like the Antarctic in the sense of having very, very little ice in summer and still a lot in winter. But the models are doing a terrible job in some sense to project what is happening there. So, for example, we had no real ice loss in the Antarctic, which we think is connected to the fact that in the Antarctic, the amount of sea ice area that we have, it's much closer linked to the wind patterns that we have compared to the Arctic. Because in the Arctic, the ice is landlocked, so it can't go anywhere, no matter how the winds blow. And so in the Arctic, the amount of sea ice primarily depends on the freezing and melting in the central Arctic Ocean, or in the Arctic Ocean itself. But in the Southern Ocean, the winds that blow from the continent, from the Antarctic continent that sits on the South Pole towards north, distributes the Arctic sea ice on the surface of the ocean. And so the amount of sea ice area that we have in the Southern Ocean is much more driven by changes in the wind patterns. And we believe that some of the fact that we have lost very little ice in the Southern Ocean so far has been related to a potential increase of these winds. But now over the past few years, we've seen a strong negative trend of Southern Ocean sea ice coverage. And it is currently unclear if that's sort of just a hiccup in the climate system and that we will go back to the sea ice that we've had before, or whether that's really is the beginning of a real trend in Southern Ocean sea ice. And the problem why we've not been able to simulate sea ice particularly well in the Southern Ocean is that many of the processes there depend on what the ocean does. And the Southern Ocean is characterized by its large amount of small-scale ocean eddies that we couldn't resolve in earlier generations of climate models. But now we are developing higher and higher resolved, spatially resolved climate models. And so it now starts to become possible to also get faithful simulations of the Southern Ocean.
From the Institute of Oceanography at Hamburg University, we've been speaking with sea ice specialist Professor Dirk Knotts. He is co-author of Breaking Science, published in the journal Nature Communications. The title is Observationally Constrained Projections of an Ice-Free Arctic, Even Under a Low Emission Scenario. Find links to that open access paper in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dirk Knotts, thank you for sharing your valuable time with our listeners.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
As you heard, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres just demanded oil companies stop investing in new supplies of climate-killing carbon. They need to wind down those operations and find a new business model in sustainable energy. But you might as well ask a fentanyl addict to switch to yoga. They have just gone out to get us more deadly drugs. Fossil fuel industries claim greater demand forces investing all their recent big profits into even more production. We just had two interviews reporting on the splurge of fossil fuel investments by the biggest banks and private investment firms. April Merlot from Rainforest Action Network named the big banks lending billions for new drilling, mining, and fracking. Then Katrin Ganswind from the German group Urgewald revealed the investment companies putting trillions more to expand fossil fuel production. It's the exact opposite of what we need to do. You can find those interviews free at ecoshock.org. Take the case of so-called natural gas. It is just methane. And in America, 80% of it comes from fracking. Of course, blowing up the underground, injecting super toxic and radioactive chemicals to get those bubbles of gas broken up. Well, nothing could be more natural than that. Right? That is where we need Greg Aitken. As Europe scrambles for gas, Greg is editor of the weekly Inside Gas Bulletin for the NGO Global Energy Monitor. This free bulletin is like an industry insider about projects that every community and activist should know about. This interview was tough technically. The phone line to the Czech Republic was poor and disconnected Greg and I at least four times. We made it happen. And I may have to interrupt now and then if a clarification is needed. Listen carefully, though. You will hear how the gas industry is ramping up methane production to save the world from climate change, apparently. Even former green voices like Germany now have methane madness. From Brno in the Czech Republic, Greg Aitken, From Brno in the Czech Republic, Greg Aitken, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi there.
Hi. So tell us about the scramble for natural gas in Europe after the sudden decline of Russian supply.
Yeah, well, obviously, last year, after Russia's invasion of Ukraine, there was a big emergency situation where EU member states that had long been very dependent on Russian gas imports. Well, first of all, there were several countries that had their supplies cut off by Russia. But Germany was facing a problem because Russia was starting to reduce flows through the Nord Stream 1 gas pipeline, which has been operating for quite some time. So really, there was just a big rush for Europe to diversify away from Russian imports. And this was also a move that was taken forward by the European Commission, which introduced a program called the Repower EU plan, which essentially was looking to set targets for diversifying from Russian gas and also to be looking at energy-saving measures, basically reducing Europe's use of or consumption of gas out to 2030, which was tying in with longer plans in the making from Europe to get off gas. But the short-term effect was to really go for this huge scramble for gas, and European buyers really switched their thoughts to LNG. Now, Europe has had, over the last 15 or so years, quite a number of LNG import terminals, which hadn't, until recently, really been working at full capacity. Because of the rush for new LNG from the likes of the US, also from Africa, from the Middle East, these existing terminals started to be operating at much closer to full capacity. And alongside that, there was a lot of rapid planning of developing new terminals. And a whole raft of new projects were proposed. Quite a few were up and running within about 6 months of the war, some new floating import terminals in the Netherlands, and others have been planned and have been set in motion, and Germany has been the main focus for the new import terminal build-out. It has currently made operational 3 new terminals in about the space of a year, and it has 6 or 7 which are currently being planned or are under construction. So it's basically just been a huge effort to scour the globe looking for new gas supplies, which has been difficult because generally we're in a tight global gas supply period at the moment. And so the result was last summer to see skyrocketing gas prices, which also had major impacts on other countries, particularly developing world countries, where the huge prices caused major problems for gas supply to these countries, Pakistan, Bangladesh, other countries in Southeast Asia, which over the course of last year saw quite lengthy power blackouts, which were damaging for the economy, for society and so forth. So there have been many kind of knock-on effects from Europe's mad dash for gas.
You know, Russia would have been sending a lot of gas to Europe and other trading partners, and now it can't. What is it doing with the gas?
Well, it's trying its best to forge new deals with the likes of China, with a couple of major pipeline deals, which appear to be moving forward quite slowly. Russia is also currently making efforts to talk to other countries in Southeast Asia for cementing new longer-term deals. At the same time, an interesting aspect in the whole Russian situation is not all pipeline gas from Russia has to the EU has been cut off. Some is still coming through a couple of pipelines, and also, interestingly, through a transit route in Ukraine. But one of the more embarrassing things, I think, for the European Union has been that supplies of Russian LNG have been coming through still to European ports, and there hasn't been, unlike with oil and other Russian products, there hasn't been a concerted effort to sanction Russian LNG flows, for example. So as far as I know, there is a lot of Russian gas which is not being exported at all and is looking to be used, I think, for new projects in Russia. But it's been trying to diversify its exports, but it's fairly slow progress at the moment. But it's certainly, I think, aware that the writing is on the wall for Europe, for exporting to Europe longer term.
Well, natural gas, as it's called, is really methane, mostly methane. In your view, Greg, is the global natural gas industry expanding production, or is it just rearranging existing markets?
That's a very wide question. Just this week, for example, Shell is holding a kind of an investor day in New York where it is about to tell the investment community that it regards gas as more than just the transition fuel, which we've heard about for the last 10 years, but Shell is reportedly set to commit to increasing its investments in upstream exploration and production. Similar noises have been made from the likes of Chevron in recent weeks. And so the oil and gas majors are certainly winding back from the transition policies which have been in place for the last few years. And I think bowing to the investor pressure that they've felt for this. At the same time, as we come up to another climate summit in United Arab Emirates in November, I think there's the alarm being raised at the fact that that conference is obviously being led by a major petrol state with also huge gas interests. And I think climate groups are alarmed at basically the fact that getting phase-out commitments from countries so far hasn't materialized. It has materialized for coal, but there's nothing on paper or has been agreed to actually to get to a phase-out agreement for oil and gas. So it's difficult to say whether gas production is being expanded, but certainly there doesn't appear to be any quieting of new announcements for new exploration and production investments, even though the International Energy Agency 2 years ago, under its net zero emission scenario, was saying there is no more room as of 2022 for new production. So it's not looking great, I would have to say.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Greg Aitken, from the Global Energy Monitor. Greg specializes in tracking world gas production. Do you know what percentage of gas is fracked compared to the old-style wells? I was just wondering.
I have to say that's difficult to know, really. I'm aware that, obviously, fracking is predominantly major technique used in North America, USA and Canada. According to the U.S. Energy Administration statistics for 2022, 80% of U.S. gas production came from shale formations. So, you know, that suggests that fracking was used for around about 80% in the U.S. Globally, I wouldn't be able to put a figure on it.
Well, I've heard that fracking is spreading to other parts of the world. Australia, Poland's talked about whether they have frackable reserves. It could spread and become a worldwide phenomenon.
Well, over the last 10 years or so, there's been a lot of speculation about fracking development globally. Australia, as you say, is one country where there have been some new developments. Argentina as well, with Vaca Muerta, major shale formation in that country, where some fracking is taking place and there are proposals for more. Generally, though, in many places that there have been moratoria put in place by national governments banning fracking. In Europe, there was a lot of fracking hype about 10 years ago, but fundamentally, the issue in Europe is much more densely populated continents and really limited water supplies, limited land available to carry out a practice which is widely regarded as being highly destructive and resource intense.
As we know, Poland built an industrial economy on coal, and now it seems everyone from the European Union to the United States will help Poland finance gas to just stop those coal emissions. Talk to us about gas politics and the outlook in Poland.
One of the interesting things about Poland is that because in the European Union context, because Poland has been really so much the bad boy in terms of its coal industry, obviously it's a decade-long industry which has, you know, dominated Polish society for a long time. But Poland has really been dragged, kicking and screaming, by the European Commission to make some concessions that the coal industry will have to decline. And so as a result of that, when it comes to Polish gas ambitions, what I've heard from colleagues in Brussels is that the European Commission is rather relieved if coal and budget at all from coal. The plans for gas expansion, despite the EU's commitments to reduce gas consumption by 2030 and thereafter, Polish gas ambitions are somehow being tolerated. They have one LNG import terminal operational. They have plans for a couple more terminals. And I think also as well, in a recent deal last week, which was agreed by the US, a US government bank, it agreed to guarantee a $500 million financial deal, which allows one of Poland's biggest energy companies to import US LNG. So there are certainly political elements to the likes of Poland being permitted to get off coal via gas. But at the same time, Poland has a wealth of renewables potential, especially offshore in the Baltic Sea. the question really has to be asked of all the EU member states which have signed up to EU greenhouse gas emission reduction targets is how long do you really want to lock in your economies to gas when you're legally obliged to be reducing your emissions?
We still hear gas promoted as a greenish bridge to a low-carbon future. Do you personally think there's enough room in the atmosphere for another few decades of burning gas?
I think gas will have to feature, and it can't be knocked out by 2030 or 2040. And I think most low-carbon scenarios see a role for gas out to 2050 and quite possibly beyond. It's just a worry and a concern that investments that are being lined up now, which are multi-decades in terms of how long they will potentially run for, that including gas, which obviously involves the combustion of methane, which is, and also much leaking methane leakage, that the prospects are, unless more and more of these investments are restricted, that we are going to blow the carbon budget because of gas.
Has any country or institution gone so far to declare methane gas is a clean, green energy?
Yeah, well, in various ways, this is still happening. In the last month or so, in Mexico, gas-fired power was reclassified by the government as clean. For instance, in the last 6 months, in several U.S. states, there have been legislative moves to call gas clean and sustainable. One of the most kind of fought-over issues in Europe in the last couple of years regarded the European Union's so-called taxonomy for financially sustainable investments. And the EU, despite much pressure and despite much protest from climate groups and scientists as well, it decided to label gas as a sustainable source of energy. It's still happening.
And tell us about the UK's advertising watchdog banning big energy greenwashing that was being pumped out on the media.
Yes, well, this is part of a sort of growing concern internationally about greenwashing claims for products of all kinds, but also marketing campaigns that are coming from major oil and gas firms. And the UK watchdog, which I think is currently drawing up new standards for what is permissible for companies to accurately show what they're doing, it took action in the last couple of weeks against Shell and against a couple of other foreign companies, which, as one sees very often, are very much heavily promoting the clean side of their businesses with electric charging points for vehicles and other nice things, which make up a minuscule percentage of these companies' business models. And the UK watchdog was basically making the point that this is all very well and good, but if you don't put this in the context of what your majority business is doing in terms of not reducing emissions, not planning to curb your production of oil and gas, then essentially you're misleading customers. So the prescription was to ban certain campaigns, particularly one from Shell.
We've been speaking with Greg Aitken, editor of Inside Gas Bulletin. Find it at www.globalenergymonitor.org. You can also find links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Greg, thank you for helping us out.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next week, we talk with Dr. Peter Carter, the medical doctor who now tries to heal the world's climate. Peter tells it like it is, and then backs all that up with climate science. I also hope to speak with Australian military analyst Elizabeth Bolton. She is telling militaries, including the U.S. Marine Corps, around the world to prepare for social chaos as climate change goes off the rails. My thanks to all the volunteers and dedicated people making nonprofit radio happen and the 106 stations that play this show. Be sure to join us again next week. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio